baseball has been America's pastime for more than 150 years. Since 1910, baseball has played a big role in the story of Charleston, West Virginia, too. I'm Eric Douglas. This hour, we'll listen to an oral history documentary I produced called Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston. It's not an exhaustive history of baseball. Rather, it is a trip through the memories of the people who went to the games and for whom the players left an indelible mark. The story is told entirely through excerpts of oral histories I recorded in 2018. Charleston has had not one, not two, but multiple professional baseball teams over the years. In this program, we're going to look at baseball over five different periods: early baseball, the Charleston Charlies, the Wheelers and Alley Cats, the struggle for a new park, and the West Virginia Power. We'll start with the Charleston Senators. Baseball really took off in 1949 when the city built Watt Powell Park in Canal City. It was named for Walter Watt Powell, who managed the Charleston Senators in the 1930s and served on the city council. He convinced the city to build the park, but died shortly before it opened 70 years ago. Let's listen to some of the people who remember opening night at Watt Powell Park.
The opening game, when the Senators baseball came back to Charleston, and my dad, even the whole family, went to the opening game. Joe Beggs was the manager, and Hobie Landreth hit a home run. Somebody else hit one. Hobie was only 19 and a great prospect for the Cincinnati Reds. He did make the majors later on, but it was an exciting night, and it was a full house. I mean, we used to draw throngs of people here, full stadiums all the time, and it maybe averaged 4,000 or 5,000 people a game. And it was just great to see the color of the grass, to hear the horse-eyed meet the hickory, and to see all the happenings of that. I fell in love.
First night that Watt Powell Park opened up, when they were in the central leg, as I was there. A big crowd. Still remember that. Pretty impressed for a kid that's probably six, seven years old. The best games I would probably remember is the reception that the Charleston Senators got the first night Watt Powell was open. People were really excited to have baseball back in the area.
So I started going to Charleston Senators. I don't remember exactly. I'll say mid, late 50s, whenever my parents would drop me off, whatever years. And then went when we were affiliated with the Twins, then also with the Pirates. So I remember Art Howe played every position. He pitched one night, so he had played every position that year. But his name's Art Howe. He ended up being manager of the Houston Astros.
That was Charlie Houck, Harry Wallace, and Mike Schock Sr. talking about the early days at Watt Powell. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, baseball continued to draw crowds.
At maybe one of the last games before the playoffs, and they had fireworks, and I was there with my parents, and I got lost. So I went to see a policeman, and the policeman made sure the word got out through the loudspeakers. But meanwhile, they took me down to the dugout, and there was a baseball player who's still alive. But he's in his 90s. His name, Wayne Terwilliger. And Wayne Terwilliger had come, I believe, from the Tigers, and he'd come down for one season and went right back up. And he was a great ball player, and he was very kind to me. And he put me on his knee and let me watch the fireworks and gave me a ball and a bat. It was a memorable time for a young boy who probably had just turned 8 years old.
So the first teams that I remember were like the late 50s Charleston Senators. There were a couple of guys, actually wound up being a third guy that moved in with him too, but they lived down the street from us, and they were guys that played on the Senators club. So somehow my dad got to know that they were there, and I don't know, maybe he spoke with them before introducing me to them. But somehow or other, through his connection, I met these guys. And there couldn't have been anything more important in the world to me than knowing professional baseball players.
It was just, to me, reading about that at the time, that Charleston was in a league competing with cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Kansas City, and some that are all major league cities now, that they were the smallest one, and I guess initially they did pretty well.
That was Danny Jones, Dick Knoll, and Jeff Dent recalling interacting with the players. The next set of memories involves feeling like they were part of the team.
the team was going to leave. So Mayor Shanklin, they sold stock in the Senators. You could buy stock for a dollar. I bought 12 shares of that stock. I thought, I own a piece of the team. This is a big deal for me. And what my dad, he finally told me, son, your stock's not worth any money. You know, I said, what do you mean? He says, the team doesn't make money. The team loses money. And so to reward the stockholders, they had a big gathering at what is now the Civic Center. And they had midget wrestling, and they had you could go in there with your stock, you get tickets, and you go in there and get a free Pepsi and a hot dog.
It was a knot hole gang, and it was a card about the size of a business card, and it was a knot hole, and it was a logo, but it was a knot hole gang for kids, and you were a knot hole gang member. You were basically on their mailing list to get stuff at the house. You know, no emails. It was no phone calls. It was, they would mail you stuff in the mailbox, the old snail mail. But I had a card. Every time you come, they'd punch it off. How many games you were there.
Had a special for those who just wanted to come in and watch the game. It was called the Knothole Club. And it cost 25 cents. But you had to sit out in the bleachers, quite a ways away from the action. But along about the sixth or seventh inning, they would open the gates. And my uncle happened to have season tickets right behind first base, which was the ideal location. So I would go and sit with him sometimes. We played such out-of-the-way places that didn't have any baseball future at that time, like Denver and St. Paul and Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And Cleveland. Cleveland was in the AAA. And the interesting part about it is, even at that time, Charleston was the smallest city in the AAA, we frequently had the best attendance.
You heard Danny Jones, Jim Strawn, and Lyle Sattis talking about attending games and being part of the baseball community. Others who remember going to the games as kids include Cal Bailey, Charles Morris, Gene Barker, and Carl Priest.
Well, my first experience with White Powell Park, when I was 14 years old, I used to go with the men's leg team hoping that someone wouldn't show up so I'd get to play. But I ended up maybe being a bat boy or chasing mm-hmm. foul balls. And it was a twilight leg, and we'd finish about the fifth inning of Charleston Senators. So we'd come to the ball game and then ride back home. The team that I was with was a team from Clendenin and Spencer. I remember one time I went to get some hot dogs for the guys that were on the team, and while I was getting the hot dogs, I got two foul balls.
I never will forget being like 9, 10 years old and walking into Walt Powell Park and how huge it was. It just seemed like to me the biggest thing in the world. And the Pinch Yankees always won the Elk River Little League thing every year. We would lose one game every year, but the minor league team would always win, and then the team who was up ahead of us, the Pinch Yankees, they would always win as well. And but going to Walt Powell Park and seeing that park for the first time, as a child was just amazing.
We would frequently ride our bicycles up there for batting practice. Mm-hmm. That's how we got our baseballs, so we could play sandlot games. And there were other boys from other neighborhoods that would come up there. It was really competitive over the left field fence during batting practice. He got hit in the head with a ball.
That was in on the railroad tracks.
It was?
Because I was ready to catch the ball, and it hit one of those wires. And it just skipped enough that it hit me right there in the head. And I went down. The ball bounced all the way down to the behind the wall, and my brother said, get the ball. He did get it. But Fred Whitfield is the batter that hit me in the head. One time we rode our bicycles all the way up to the ballpark. This was about between 65 and 70. Climbed over the fence. There's probably, 12 of us at least. Climbed over the fence and played the baseball game.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that.
Then we climbed back out and went home. They didn't have a team at that time.
After the Charleston Senators left, the city's baseball team became the Marlins.
That we got the Marlins in, came in, I think they came in June. that year because a hurricane had struck in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where his team was playing, and the San Juan Marlins became the Charleston Marlins because their ballpark was tore up. So we took it over. It was a good thing because they had a really good ball club. Charleston just happened to have a baseball park because we didn't have a team that year. And so they managed to get it open and bring the team in, and they were really good and some really good ball players. They ended up playing on some of the Cardinals' better ball clubs.
That Marlins team I was speaking of, which was a Triple-A team for the Cardinals, that was like 61, I think. And in 64, they won the World Series over the Yankees, and several of the guys on that team had been on that Charleston team. Probably the most famous for not only playing but broadcasting was Tim McCarver. He was like 19 years old and the catcher for Charleston and ended up with the Cardinals' long major league career and announcing career. And there was a pitcher named Ray Washburn, which was one of their top pitchers for Cardinals for years. And they had a couple infielders named Dal Maxville and Julian Javier, who played for years with the Cardinals. They were all on that Charleston team.
Well, in 61, I was still playing Little League Baseball. I was 11 that summer. And when arrangements were being made, you know, all that happened pretty quickly. One of the coaches on our Little League Baseball team worked on the grounds crew at the ballpark at Watt Powell Park. And so, you know, he knew that they were scrambling to put a staff together and everything like that. And so he asked if I wanted to be a bat boy for the team. And I'm sure that he didn't have hiring authority, I don't suppose, but I suppose he could recommend me to whoever did. I don't remember exactly how that all played out, but I was able to do it. You know, I was chosen to do it. So from age 11 there in 1961 through the 64 season, I was a bat boy there for the 4 years that we had minor league teams up there at Watt Powell Park.
You heard Mike Schock Sr., Jeff Dent, and Dick Knoll in that segment. The team they were remembering, the Marlins, only lasted 1 year. The owners moved them back to Miami. In 1962, Charleston fielded a new team called the Charleston Indians. They played for 3 seasons until Charleston was left without a baseball team in 1964. You're listening to Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston. It's an oral history documentary of minor league baseball in Charleston, West Virginia. I'm Eric Douglas. After nearly a decade without a baseball team, baseball returned to Charleston in 1971 with the Charleston Charlies. They were a AAA affiliate of several teams, but started out with the Pittsburgh Pirates.
We were not aware of how fortunate and how lucky we were to have a AAA baseball team in such a small market. And for the Pittsburgh Pirates, the lumber company, as they were known in the 70s, they were very good. So these Charlies, if they could make it to the Pirates, which many of them did, many of the Charleston Charlies in the early 70s made it to Pittsburgh. So now we're watching Major League stars, all-stars, and World Series winners finally in 79. That World Series was so personal to me because I knew half the roster.
On that first night when baseball was back in Charleston, because it had left in 64, Dad took me to the game. It was packed. There were probably 6,000 people there. We sat down the right field line that night in bleachers.
But then in 71, when the Charlies came to town and they were affiliated with the Pirates, and we had so many players that were coming through and going to the majors, and that was, you know, at the time I would have been 10, and so that was just real exciting.
Taking autographs. I spent the year getting an autographed baseball of the Charleston Charlies team. Bruce Keeson, Richie Zisk, Charlie Howard, Rennie Stennett.
That was Jim Strawn, Andy Richardson, Russ Young, and Terry Hess talking about the Charleston Charlies. As a way to help sell tickets to the ballpark, the owners hosted special promotions to draw in new crowds.
remember Union Carbide night. The place was packed. There were cars up and down McCorkle Avenue on both sides. And the park, you couldn't move. It was just, you know, thousands and thousands of people because they had all those giveaways and special events and, you know, things of that nature and always entertainment going on.
Charleston's getting ready to play the first game. And we decided, let's change course here and support Jim Campanis. So we had gigantic curtain rods, wooden curtain rods, and we got two sheets, and we wrote in gigantic letters. One said, "Almost Heaven, Jim Campanis," on one sheet. The other sheet said, "Campy's Corner." And we attached them to these two gigantic curtain rods. So Jimmy comes up, and as I mean, he was right-handed, and he comes up, he's first at bat, and he looks down third base, his worst nightmare, right? And we are going crazy, and we've got those two banners, and we're jumping up in the air, and he sees Campy's Corner and Almost Having Jim Campanis. And guess what he does? Hits a home run.
My mother always would get us box seats right behind first base, and I figure they were only like a couple of dollars a piece. You know, Coke was a dime or a quarter, maybe popcorn, you know, same thing. So, you know, everything's relative, but, you know, it was fairly inexpensive to go to a ball game compared to today's. And you can't get access to the players at all. One time we went to, me and my mother now, we went to Lexington to see the Charlies play. And Gary Kolb was a player on the Charlies. And he came out of the dugout, and we were sitting right behind the third base dugout because they were visiting. Right. And he saw me sitting there, and he went back into the dugout, come out and tossed me a ball because he'd recognize us from Charleston.
Gary Kolb and Cal Bailey still live in Charleston, but both men played for the Charlies. Terry Hess remembered watching Cal Bailey play.
When we won the pennant here in 73, we were loaded. We really had a good team. And I remember at the end of the year, of course, they called a lot of guys up. It was so bad that I played first base and batted fourth. I'll tell you how much they took away from us. I never liked to play with anything on my arms. Just a phobia I had about anything on my elbows. And I remember playing third base. In the first two innings, I was fine. And I'd go out for the third or fourth inning, and man, it'd be cold, that breeze. And I said, what's going on here? And I get Mission Hollow, was that the name of it? And they said, that breeze comes out of Mission Hollow. Well, obviously it helped right-hand hitters, because you left-hand hitter, you sitting into that wind, and believe it or not, it's a lot stiffer than everybody thought of.
You know, Coach Cal Bailey at West Virginia State, I got his autograph. He's on this ball here. Hmm. And he was on that Charleston Charlies team, and I got his autograph a number of times. And my nephew played baseball for Coach Cal down at West Virginia State, and I made some copies of his autographs and sent it to him. And he told my nephew he never turned down an autograph, never turned down an opportunity to sign an autograph.
I've had several people to tell me they remembered coming down the bullpen, and of course little kids, they want baseballs all the time, and me giving them baseballs, I kind of kept a store of batting practice balls. One of the most glaring memories was they had Cal Bailey night, and they brought me in to pitch in relief against the Richmond Braves, to a right-handed batter, and they pinch hit a left-handed batter for him. And I threw four pitches in the dirt and walked him, and they took me out. It was in the playoffs in 1970. At the end of the season, 1971, we needed to win two out of the last three games to get in the playoffs. I got to pitch in two of those games, and then I got to pitch in both the playoff games against the Tidewater Tides. And in both games, the last hit I gave up was home runs to John Milner. Sliders down and in, hit in the same place, one at Watt Powell and one down at Tidewater.
Next up, we'll hear memories of one of the most famous players for the Charleston Charlies, Dave Parker.
My dad knew Bob Levine, who brought him back, and he got Dad to be in charge of all the ticket sales and all the tickets at Watt Powell Park. And it's interesting, I don't know if people understand how the team got its name. It was Bob's dad, Poor Charlie, who always wore a derby and always had a cigar. But we were in the office.
I can remember several things. One was one day Dave Parker came in to the office, fully clothed from the waist down, shirtless from the waist up. And I thought he was the most physically perfect specimen that I had ever seen. I mean, like a 32-inch waist and a 50-inch shoulder width, and he was a man among men.
Dave Parker's a really young guy, 18 or 19 years old. You can just tell this young man is on his way. And there's a train going by over towards Mission Hall, and he really lit in with a pitch. Really hit it hard. Well, it landed in the back of a coal train going by. And the legend is that it didn't stop until it got to Columbus, Ohio. And that's a good story. I've heard it a few times myself, and I saw it happen.
Dave Parker was playing with the Charlies, and they took someone up, and it might have been Al Oliver, I don't know, I don't remember that, but they took somebody to the big leagues, and he got mad and went home. And so when the big shots in Pittsburgh called him and told him to get back down there, he said he wasn't coming. He was going, if he played any more ball, he was going to play in the big leagues. So he said, all right, we'll take it, and he never came back. He was, I think he played 15, maybe 18 years.
Yeah, Parker was kind of he was in between leagues. He was too good for this league, and they said he wasn't good enough for the majors, but I think he proved them wrong on that. He's a player. He kind of boycotted, and he gave him an alternative. Either you take him to the big leagues or he's going home.
That was Jim Berner, Mike Schock Sr., Cal Bailey, and Gary Kolb. The players and managers from the Charlies also had an effect outside of the game.
Charlies also ended up being a bit of a cradle for managers. Bobby Valentine, Tony La Russa, Willie Randolph, Louis Pujols, Art Howe, all of these guys came through Charleston and played here. And some had respectable careers in the majors, and others maybe not so much, but became very, I mean, Tony La Russa was a great manager with the Oakland Athletics, and I believe he was with the Cards at some point too.
Roger Pauley was my baseball coach. Roger Pauley was very entrenched with the Charleston Charlies. He knew the president, he knew the managers, he knew the organization personnel pretty well. I thought that was a big deal when I was 10 years old. Roger Pauley brought to our little league field in Meadowbrook three Charleston Charlies for our practice. Richie Zisk, who went on to have a pretty good career with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Dick Sharon, not a great pro career, but played for the Detroit Tigers. And Gene Garber, who went on to have a stellar career in the major leagues with probably 8 to 9 to 10 different teams, played for quite a few teams, Gene Garber. Fond memories, great pictures, got instructions from Richie Zisk, Dick Sharon, Gene Garber. As a 10, 11-year-old, I already had the bug. Now I'm bitten, and it's in my veins and in my blood, and it's running through me pretty good.
That was Andy Richardson and Jim Strawn. This is Batter Up! Baseball in Charleston, a documentary about minor league baseball. I'm Eric Douglas. We've been exploring the history of baseball in West Virginia through the storied history of the different players and teams in Charleston. The Charleston Charlies moved to Maine following the 1983 season. After again going without baseball for 3 years, a new team arrived in Charleston in 1987. Named for the historic river boats that plied the rivers, the Wheelers were a single-A team. In 1995, the team changed its name to the Alley Cats and continued playing in Watt Pell Park until 2004.
And I like single-A ball. I've been to double-A ball. That's real competitive. But single-A, they have that, you know, they're all competing to make it, and they have the love of the game, and not to, their heads aren't in the clouds.
The crowds turned out. It didn't seem like you really had to have a giveaway to have an attraction, you know, to get people there. I mean, there was a buzz about the Wheelers that I have not seen since.
So the 90 team, and remember, Dan Wilson was the catcher, and he's probably the most highly touted player. And it's one of the first games, he threw someone out at second from his knees, and I said, oh, this guy might work out okay.
That was Terry Ofish, James Workman, and Phil Kabler. The winning streak continued, and so did the enthusiasm.
I remember Don Cook saying that something about, you know, the winning streak, and should they win, I think it was 10 games in a row, but he said that he would shave his head. He would let the players shave his head. And they, you know, got wind of it, and I mean, it just became kind of a rallying thing for them. And it happened, and he was true to it. Before the one of the games, they brought him down right behind home plate, right in front of the crowd. And, I mean, he let the players shave. They took, like, the electric clippers first, took off. And he had a lot of hair. Took the hair off, and then he let them lather him up and shave it.
Final game of the championship was here. I can remember it's a big crowd. And of course, they cut off beer sales at the seventh, end of the seventh, but there was a convenience store right next to Watt Powell Park, so we sent somebody on a beer run to bring beer back from the convenience store so we could have it to celebrate the championship.
Out of that 91 group, there was a great bunch of guys, and Dan Wilson.
Dan Wilson, yeah.
So Seattle Mariners catcher. And we've been very lucky, too, because we hold one of the bats that has all their signatures on it.
Got to figure out where that bat is.
But, no, that was a terrific group. And even better, the manager was a West Virginian, Jim Lett.
In that segment, we heard stories from James Workman, Phil Kabler, and Jason Black. A big plus to single-A baseball is the connections the fans get to make with the players. They become host families and see them on the streets around town.
Louis Ordaz and Johnny Carvajal, they were the shortstop infield combination, but they were behind Barry Larkin and I think Pee Wee Reese at the time. So after a couple of years, they got traded. But Louis made it with the Cardinals, and during the Mark McGwire era of him breaking the home run record, and Johnny made it to AAA a couple of times, and both of them are now in coaching there.
Lynn Petrie was going to head it all up. Her and her husband had, you know, said we'll take the lead and that kind of stuff, because the Bestines had it in Charlotte when they had the team in Charlotte before they moved it up to Charleston. And so we said, well, we'll try it and see what happens. And the first year, Tim Cecil. And so we found out what they liked. We helped them out finding places to stay around here. We fed them. Every time he had a great game, I made him cheesecake. So he had a lot of cheesecake and pork chops. I made a lot of cheesecake and pork chops that year.
That was Terry Ofish and Robin Black talking about spending time with young players on the way up. Next up is the origin of a notable baseball character, the Toast Man.
One of the first was Rafael Bustamante. Don't know if it was the first, but he's the one that's etched in my mind. Shortstop, he was here for parts of two seasons. I'll say Busta, you say Monte, Busta, Monte, and people start getting into it. Dan Wilson was a first rounder for the Reds that year, came after signing. I'll say Bookham, you say Dano. So we started doing cheers for the players. By the next year, people were saying, well, what do you have for this guy? Mm. And it kind of became an obligation. But by the next year, we had a guy named Tom Raffo. And we came up with a cheer, Smasho, Raffo. And he was a great hitting first baseman and had at least two or three walk-offs, I think, that year. And that started picking up. And we would sit in the blue seats because those were a little cheaper. with home plate to our down to our right and the visitors dugout down to our left. Somebody said, I attribute it to George Manahan. I don't think it was me. Somebody said, you are toast. And I thought, well, that'll cheer because it's you are toast. And so we just started saying,
you are toast. You are toast. You are toast.
And I made a little sign to, so people would join in. And that was 1991. And by 1992, we were doing it all the time. And that's when 1992 is when we were heading back to the playoffs again. 91, we made 90, we won the championship. Swept through the championship. Started counting down the outs at nine more outs. If for every game that we had a lead, we started doing nine more outs, all the way down to one. And the next year we were in the playoffs, but lost, I think, in the championship series. I'd want to have to look it up, but I think to Columbia. 92, Dennis said, you know, why don't we make toast? I'm like, all right, how do we do that? He said, well, if you have to sit in the front row, where I end up sitting for years, and there's a plug in play. So the bat boy would have to plug you in. Jason Caulfield was the bat boy. You have to plug you in, but you can set up a little tray and a little toaster and make toast and then pass it out to people so they'll wave it.
I'll say power up, you say the toaster, power up!
The thing about what you're supposed to do with a toast is you're supposed to wave it. Hold it up and wave it. And we have one picture someplace of dozens of people holding up the toast along with me as I'm pointing enthusiastically at the strikeout victim and ushering them back to the dugout. So that's how that all started. It was 1992, and it was Dennis Bastien's idea, and I was like, all right.
That was Rod Blackstone describing one of the most famous traditions in minor league baseball. For this documentary, I spoke with several former bat boys, but none worked quite as long as Jason Caulfield.
July 13th, 1992, and I was sitting behind home plate in the gold seats, waiting to go on duty, because I didn't go on duty. I didn't start selling until the first pitch. And one of the office personnel comes up to me, goes, Pop. I'm like, yeah. He goes, do you want to be bat boy? I was like, yeah, duh. So they take me into the clubhouse. They get me suited up in uniform. And what do you know, there starts my 7-year career as bat boy. 96, coming off my South Atlantic League Bat Boy of the Year award season, Rod Blackstone was office personnel because he was no longer doing what he was doing with Congressman Wise. So he did PA announcing, and he got myself my own promotion. It was called the Physical Company Foul, Five Straight Foul Fly Phenomenon. And any foul ball that went up on that screen and came down, if I caught five in a row, then a lucky fan would win like two or four free tickets to upcoming Alicat games, and I would get $5 towards the gift certificate, which was the fifth quarter. Now, if I would drop one, my streak would end.
And a quick reminder to always pay attention at the ballpark from Alan Fleischman.
In 2002, I was over at the beer trough. The beer trough was a big tub of ice loaded with different beers. Suddenly I heard, heads up! So I looked up, of course. Obviously a foul ball had been hit into the stands. I looked up for a few seconds but saw nothing. The beer trough was tucked neatly aside the right side stands, out of the sunshine, but only about 75 feet away from home plate, but not in direct line of sight to the plate. And I was unaware that the batter had fouled that baseball nearly straight up in the air. And it eventually came down, right, with a clunk on top of my head. Fortunately, I have a hard head and was wearing a hat, but boy, did that smart. And I have that ball right here. And on the ball, it says, May 21st, 2002. This ball hit Alan on the head.
You're listening to Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston. It's an oral history documentary of minor league baseball in Charleston, West Virginia. I'm Eric Douglas. In 2003, after more than five decades of baseball, Watt Pal Park was to close its doors for good. The owners of the team wanted to build a new ballpark. But not everyone felt the same way. Many have fond memories from the last season and last night at Watt Pal. Others dealt with the fight over the new park.
They had a final season promotion at Watt Pal 1 year, and then things got delayed. And, well, there was another development that they had all these economic development grants projects approved, and then there was a lawsuit saying you can't use lottery money this way, so that caused another year delay while the lawsuit was resolved. So the final year at Watt Pal became a two-year event.
One of the last Two for Tuesdays at the old ballpark. Now, that was back whenever you had 32-ounce beers. And Two for Tuesday, Billy Bob would start trying to put beers on his hands in little trays. And the last Two for Tuesday, he figured, okay, he's going to try the biggest one ever. And it was 48 of those. 48 beers stacked in almost a pyramid as he's walking up from the beer stand to the landing area.
Magical moment in Charleston baseball. Very last game of Watt Pal Park. And it was joyous and it was bittersweet. And I don't know if we had permission to do this, but when the game was over, we were on the field. And I can remember everyone running the base paths, and it was just, you just knew it was a moment that you're never going to forget.
I think I went to the last game, the very last game, because I knew the season was ending. I think I went to the last game, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a sad day because I was just getting ready to retire, and I thought, man, I can go to all the games I want because I don't have to worry about going to work. And then they moved downtown.
That was Phil Cadler, Rod Blackstone, Danny Boyd, and Gene Barker. The decision to build a new park was a struggle. It took 2 years to finally make it happen.
In 2003, we were going to lose the team. Jay wanted to build a new stadium, and there were a lot of serious questions about why we needed to build a new stadium. And one question for me was the keepsake of the old Watt Pal Park was, I mean, I was there in the 50s when it was new and people were spitting tobacco on the bathroom floor. We would go to those ball games and I'd say, well, I don't think this place is such a dump. And then I got educated and I realized it was a dump and it needed to go and we needed to do it. So during the campaign of 2003, I had to be very careful with my support for the ballpark. And because I'd done a poll, and 64% of the people in this city were adamantly opposed to building a new park. 10% were somewhat opposed. And I'm trying to win an election. So I it's not like I dodged the questions, but I was glad when they weren't asked because I was going to get it done.
Lynn Brookshire, George Manahan, and I created WV Wins, West Virginians Willing to Invest in a New Stadium, as a citizen lobbyist group to try to demonstrate that there was support for this, and researched what it meant or what it could mean. We used the example of Myrtle Beach and how a new ballpark increased the attendance at Myrtle Beach Pelican games, or I'm not even sure they're Pelicans, Myrtle Beach games. We had the example of Altoona, which was a smaller city. Altoona smaller than Charleston, Blair County smaller than Kanawha. Look at what they've done in Altoona with a new ballpark. Mm-hmm. And their numbers, and we can experience that same improvement here. It's not just about the perfunctory 500 people that are there every night, that there's more enormous possibility. And realizing, I think, trying to get this message across as much as possible, if we lost the team, if they moved it to Montgomery, Alabama, we would probably not have an affiliated baseball team here today.
And so I was, I guess, kind of a leader of a vocal group that was advocating for keeping the park where it is. Now, in hindsight, I still in my heart believe that with less money, that the old park could have been rehabbed, and it could have become a kind of an interesting mix of history and new updated facility. You know, given that, I'm really glad that the new park ended up where it is. You know, in midtown, because there were some discussions about other locations that would have put it, you know, further west. You know, for myself personally, I can't imagine myself going to ball games, you know, from Charleston, driving from Charleston out there to go to a ball game, you know. So I'm glad it ended up where it is. And it is a nice facility.
That was Danny Jones, Rod Blackstone, and Russ Young. When it came time to play the first game in the new park, some minds were changed.
We were totally against closing down Walpole Park. Totally, totally, totally against it. Until I stepped into Power Park for the first time, in less than 30 seconds, I went, I was wrong. This is awesome. You know, things change. It you know, I miss the nostalgia of Walpole Park, of course. But there are so many more pluses now because of Power Park.
I think the new ballpark kind of enlivened me a little bit. I remember we were there for the groundbreaking. And when they said they were building that new ballpark there, I thought, are they crazy? But it's an ideal spot, and it's a beautiful ballpark. Easy to get to. Of course, parking is always a problem in any ballpark. It's a nice ballpark, especially for A ball.
Whatever area that you're in, you have such a beautiful view. Whether you're looking out from first base and third base, if you're looking from third base, you're seeing the state capitol. If you're looking for first base, you're seeing, you know, those nice, you know, old warehouses that have kind of converted. There are beautiful buildings now, the cemetery up on the hill. Go to the outfield and look between the boxes they have for the media and those other boxes they have, and it's a beautiful view of the city, the sun setting over through there, so the ballpark is perfectly placed.
You heard Danny Boyd, Gary Kolb, and Charles Morris talking about the new baseball stadium built in downtown Charleston in time for the start of the 2005 season. In a minute, we'll hear recent memories of Power Park. I'm Eric Douglas. We'll be right back. In honor of West Virginia's birthday, today we're listening to an oral history documentary called Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston, the story of professional baseball in Charleston, West Virginia. In 2005, safely at home in the new park, the team changed its name to the West Virginia Power. They hope to represent the entire state, not just the city of Charleston.
I don't remember what the exact attendance. I mean, it was full. All the seats were full. You know, all standing room. You know, and stuff. All that was pretty. So it was a full. It was probably, if I was guessing, I would say it was probably about, 6,000, something like that. And it was a picture perfect night. It wasn't too hot. It wasn't too cool. It was just the sun was out. It was setting. So it was just a spectacular night. Yeah, my parents enjoyed it. Tremendously and stuff, and you know, it's one of the things when I think about my parents. And I actually have the opening night. I have a picture of opening night they took in the article in the newspaper, and I had it dry mounted, and it's actually in my office. But you know, I think of my parents and stuff when I look at that all the time.
You can't lose with baseball, and we've had meetings there, we've had parties there, we've had gatherings there. It's something, you've had weddings there. It's something you can't lose on. And if you're a beer drinker, you can go there and have a gathering and make sure you plan your ride home. But it's a heck of a deal. And as I reflect on it, it's hard to believe in my lifespan, my experience with baseball, and how I've personally been able to affect it, first as a shareholder for the old Charleston Senators, and then as the mayor to try to lead the effort to help save the team that's here now.
Well, I say the first night the
it was chaotic. They were bringing him slips. They'd think of something, just write on it and bring it up, like announce this and that. I mean, there ended up being a method to it, but there was just so much going on. It's because they, I mean, they cover it all. I mean, there's just a lot going on. What compared to Watt Powell, they added all more things. You had the Giant Kong course. You had all these stations for kids.
That was Charles Morris, Danny Jones, and Mike Schock Jr. For many fans, baseball is about more than the game.
Baseball is the only mythology America has. America is so young that it hasn't had enough time to have mythology. And I contend baseball is the only thing that has the mythos that we all share. It's been long enough where the legends change and you hear all the stories. You know, you got the story of Dave Parker hitting the longest home run, you know, from Watt Powell to Cincinnati, I guess, in the Coltrane. He says it's true. I wasn't there, but I'm going to believe it.
It's just like a social thing. You know, just come and you'll see people you know, especially in Charleston. I said any game, you know, and it's just a nice, relaxing summer evening. And somewhere the breeze comes in. Not as good as Watt Powell, but there's a nice little breeze every now and then that comes behind, like, the press box.
Like, one thing about Watt Powell is that it had the grandstand. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of seats, hundreds of seats under the grandstand. And so a lot of people would sit there to avoid the sun on a sunny day. And, of course, on a rainy day, it's the only place mm-hmm. that you could sit and stay dry, assuming that the game was going on. And so at the new park, there's none of that. I mean, I enjoy the new park. I like going there. But it does strike me as odd that, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, the crowds are really sparse. And I think it's a direct result of not having any place to get out of the sun.
That was Danny Boyd, Terry Ofish, and Russ Young. The chance to spend time with the players is key to some fans like Lisa Kolb and Robin Black.
I think it's all come full circle for me now with my involvement as a sponsor parent, if you will, for the Power, and getting involved in those kids' lives, because, you know, they're my boys' age and they're away from their families and they're just trying to make a dream come true, and it's not an easy life. And like Dad said, I go to the games for a totally different reason than most people do that are there, and so I hope baseball stays in Charleston for a while.
We don't expect anything out of doing what we do for the players, and we tell them that. We're here to make them feel at home, have a good summer, enjoy their time here in West Virginia, and just, you know, you never know. When you see us coming up the ladder of where you're going, we just, you know, hey, drop us a ticket here right now and then.
That's it.
Yeah, but we have gotten baskets of stuff from their state because one of my traditions is I send something West Virginian with their scrapbook when I do their scrapbooks, and those normally go about Thanksgiving.
Earlier, we heard the origin story of Toastman. It is a legend that continues to grow. The Toastman is still around today, nearly 30 years after he began cheering for the Charleston Wheelers.
Rod is the life of Charleston baseball. In 2005, I was on a ferry going to Alcatraz as a tourist. And I ran into a baseball player from Arizona, and he'd heard of Rod. I mean, Rod's well-known in baseball throughout the country. And he doesn't like people saying things about him because he doesn't need the accolades. He doesn't do it for that reason. He does it to have fun. So they've got that toaster on top of the that simulated toaster on top of the roof. I mean, it's the most unique situation in the entirety of minor league baseball anywhere.
He's so much above everybody else as far as a fan with his knowledge. The guy studies the players like he's getting ready for his dissertation. I mean, he knows everything about every minor league baseball player for every team, opposing team that comes here.
If it becomes about me, then that's the wrong thing it's mm-hmm. about. It needs to be about the fun. It needs to be about the greater experience. It needs to be about the friends you make at the ballpark, the memories you create, and the guys who are trying to fulfill their dreams on the field. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. This little evolutionary thing might add to the flavor and add to the fun, but no, it needs to be about them. And I think that's why that's why I'm dedicated to cheering for them every time they come up. We do not heckle the home team, period, ever in our section without getting hard looks and talking to. Because every time they come up, whether they're 4 for 5 or 0 for their last 20, they're still our team. And we want to support them, and we want them to know that we support them. It's a world of fun. I'll probably be doing it until I'm like on a walker or making my way down. Last time I'll be, "You are toast. I am toast." I joked about that too. But I want my remains, my ashes, to be spread in the visitors' on deck circle.
That was Danny Jones, Jim Strawn, and Rod Blackstone. For Danny Boyd, the ballpark is magical.
For close to 20 years now, when I think about it, I can tell you my favorite spot on the planet Earth. It was sitting with Steve Utt all these years, near where we are now at Watt Powell Park, and now at our new place in Power Park. So if I need to go to my happy place, I think about that. Baseball's good for the soul, and it's just a healing place. And I don't mean, this is cliche when people say it's like church, but it is like church. You know, it's a place for community, and it's relaxed, and you can reflect, and you can absorb the horrors as we have many years, and the joys as well.
For many fans, baseball is the basis for lifelong memories, remembering time with family or friends, special moments watching the game. For Gene Barker,
baseball is about the players and the friends you make. I just love the game, the way it's played. I love batting. I love fielding. I love everything about the game. I would rather watch it at live than I would on TV, because you get the atmosphere of the ballpark and everything.
This was Batter Up, Baseball in Charleston, an oral history documentary of minor league baseball in Charleston, West Virginia. Now it's time to head back out to the ballpark. Cheer for the home team and enjoy the atmosphere. Play ball. This project was made possible with support from Festival, A City Becomes a Work of Art, the West Virginia Culture Center Archives Library, Ray, Winton, and Kelly, PLLC, and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Organ music courtesy of Matt Jackford. Baseball crowd sounds were recorded at Power Park in Charleston, West Virginia. Thanks go to Roxy Todd for editing this project and to Patrick Stevens for mixing the sound. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Douglas.